Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. This is our weekly news roundup, and we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
Also joining us in the studio today in his role as a reporter at the Mashpee Enterprise, a familiar voice to our listeners, Sam Houghton. It's good to have him here. We will be speaking also with Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Later in the program, we'll check in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. Taking a look now at some of the news this week around the Cape and the islands, Patrick Cassidy, the man accused of killing Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, has been indicted. Give us an update here.
Sure, and this is not really a surprise. This was Thomas Latanowicz. He's 30. He's from Somerville at the time of his arrest, apparently. He is the man accused of shooting and killing, as you said, Sergeant Gannon on April 12th of this year in Marston's Mills as Sergeant Gannon. For anybody who doesn't remember this, and it's certainly the largest story of the year here on the Cape is, as far as things go, anybody who doesn't remember this, Sergeant Gannon was helping to serve an arrest warrant on Latanowicz at the time for a probation violation, and he was searching an attic space, was shot and killed, allegedly, by Latanowicz. Latanowicz was arrested. He also shot Sergeant Gannon's canine, mm-hmm. his police dog. Sergeant Gannon was a canine officer with the Yarmouth Police Department. That dog survived, but Gannon did not, and so Latanowicz was charged with murder, with the charge of murder in that case in district court. This is essentially bumping it up to Superior Court at this point, and that's really what this indictment does, is it brings it up to a court where there are stiffer penalties. It's was obvious that this was going to end up in Superior Court for anybody who knows the court systems. He also faces eight other charges, you know, that have to do with firearms, and the one that kind of jumped out at me and something that's been certainly made a lot of in this case is he's charged with being an armed career criminal, and that was something that everybody was pointing to from the get-go, was that this was a person who had more than 100 charges, counts against him in different courts across the Cape and beyond when he was arrested. And there was a lot of question at the time as to what he was doing free and why he was even out of jail. And we did a lot of reporting. Our reporters did a lot of reporting on that. Incidentally, to a certain extent, this week as well, Governor Baker signed a bill approving a $2 tax on rental car mm-hmm. contracts to pay for police training. This is something that police have been pushing for vigorously, and something that Yarmouth Police Chief Frank Fredrickson, I'm sure it's very bittersweet. He says, you know, the death of his officer helped propel this forward. It was something that had been brought up in previous years, previous budgets, and hadn't gotten through, and it got through this week, the same day. Governor Baker signed this the same day that Latanowicz was indicted on these nine charges, including murder.
And there's a sense that there was some connection that Gannon's death definitely helped propel this bill forward.
Absolutely, and I think there were certainly other law enforcement personnel who died in this year, but there seemed to be some momentum. And as it turns out, Chief Fredrickson had been somebody who had been pushing very hard for this himself over the years. This was not something that just came up after Sergeant Gannon was killed, but something that Chief Fredrickson had been pushing for. And then obviously when people looked at this, they said, you know, police need more training. A reporter asked Chief Fredrickson kind of what might have been different if they had had mm-hmm. training. And he said he didn't know, you know, on that day when Sergeant Gannon was killed, what could have been done differently, how training could have helped in that situation. But he mentioned a bunch of areas where his officers need additional training, including dealing with the mentally ill, interrogations, use of force, field sobriety tests, peer support and mental wellness training and survival training. So these are all issues that have come up previously with police training. And again, in this case, this bill will go forward and this money will go towards, I think, about $10 million a year is expected to be raised through this bill.
And Fredrickson in the article calling it the biggest piece of pro-police legislation in the past 45 years. That's
a substantial statement. Yeah. And, you know, $10 million may not, you know, in this day and age may not seem like a lot, but when you're, you know, working on shoestring budgets and trying to put things together, the police look for additional money for training. And this is where some of that's going to come from.
Let's speak now about the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. The tribe is fighting to keep its reservation intact. There was a hearing in Washington this week to assure that the tribe hopes that that happens. Sam Houghton was in Washington to cover the hearing for the Sandwich Enterprise. Cape Cod Times also covered this. Sam, let's start with you. Tell us, how important is this bill for the tribe?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it essentially protects its reservation in Mashpee and Taunton. And a reservation for a tribe is everything. You know, it's their land. They get funding from it. Cedric Carmel, who was at the hearing on Tuesday, he said if they lose this reservation, it could threaten their school, obviously threaten their land, a lot of funding for different programs.
Cromwell's the tribal chairman. Yeah.
He's the chairman, right. So it would be he said devastating. So I think it's a pretty big deal. And this bill would essentially override any lawsuits and protect the tribe's land.
Now, this did not unfold perhaps as the tribe had hoped it would go.
So there's no action taken on Tuesday. And I guess we cover kind of two aspects of this hearing. One aspect was just what unfolded. And actually, what I thought was kind of interesting was several members on the board, and in fact, all spoke very highly of this bill, which is surprising. You had Democrats and Republicans, congressmen. A few Democrats, I thought was very interesting, actually apologized to the tribe for mm-hmm. having to go through this, considering, you know, that they were the tribe who greeted the Pilgrims in Plymouth, and here they are having to fight for their land through legislation. And a couple, you had a Republican on the side, you know, urging the executive branch of the government to support this, and which was kind of a shock, as the Cape Cod Times, their story ran. It was a shock that the executive branch didn't actually back this bill. He was kind of on the actual hot seat and didn't support the bill, which is interesting. And another aspect of this bill that we covered, or this hearing, was this fear of precedent. There were a lot of other tribes there, you know, supporting the Mashpees, but also there's a fear that if the Mashpee tribe loses its reservation, that this could happen across anywhere else mm-hmm. in the country. And there was a lot of talk about a return to what was called the termination period. It's actually the 1950s. The federal government, it was their policy to assimilate tribes rather than, you know, let them live off their land and work towards self-governance. They actually, you know, pushed for assimilation, which meant disestablishing a lot of reservations. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of fear in Indian country that this bill or disestablishing the Mashpee Reservation would set a very dangerous precedent.
Patrick.
And just interesting, as you're talking there, Sam, I mean, disestablishing a reservation that they only just kind of secured through the Interior Department's previous decision mm-hmm. that then was remanded to the Interior Department by a judge after this lawsuit by neighbors in Taunton who were really fighting the casino is what they're worried about, and the land is how the tribe gets to this casino plan that they have in Taunton. But as you mentioned, Daryl LeConte, who's the acting director of Bureau of Indian Affairs, who was testifying there, it was interesting for us. We weren't down in D.C., but we were ready to you know, report, and we were planning on posting something before the testimony began because his testimony had been released and had been submitted as it was going to be read. The Associated Press picked up on it, rightfully so. They were given this testimony that he was going to read, and in that testimony there was a specific line that said, "We, the Interior Department, are supporting this legislation." And then he got on again the proverbial hot seat, and right before going on to speak, apparently that line was ripped out of the testimony, and we were about to publish our own story about, hey, they're going to support the bill, and learned that line had come out and quickly changed it, and were able to get something up that said that they were taking no position, which is what they ended up doing. But as you said, Sam, this is a bill that would basically affirm that reservation land, and Congress can do that because they make the laws, and they would kind of override any sort of judicial action here.
We're going to speak right now with Bill Evel, who is the managing editor at the Vineyard Gazette. Bill joins us for the first time on this program. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Bill, a stretch of waterfront commercial property in Vineyard Haven Harbor is coming up for sale. There's a group there that's forming a nonprofit to try to buy this property. They want to save it as working waterfront. Tell us about this.
Exactly. We learned this week that four properties owned by the DeSourcy family have come up for sale. Now, if you come in on the steamship ferry, if you look to the left, you can see a large white building that says DeSourcy on it. People probably seen that a lot, but now it actually resonates. They have four properties in there. There's 1.8 acres, 185 feet of waterfront, and there are several working businesses there. Gannon Benjamin Marine Railway, that's the boat building concern that started in 1980. The Martha's Vineyard Times, there are two art galleries, two apartments, a commercial warehouse, and the former site of a paint store. And it's a really area of critical concern because it's right on the water there. So the asking price is $8 million, but it's not open to the public market yet. Instead, they offered it privately to a nonprofit group, which includes Nat Benjamin of Gannon and Benjamin Marine Railway. The group is now trying to raise money. They also want to start creating maybe a vision statement, bringing in the public to talk about it, because what they really want to do, they said, maintain the existing businesses, but also open up the area more to the public. Right now, you sort of drive by on Beach Road, or you can see it from the waterfront, but there's not a lot of intermingling.
Mm-hmm.
John McDonald, he's a member of the museum board. He is the head of this group. As you know, I think the museum is now a new player over in Vineyard Haven. They were in Edgartown for many, many years, but they recently bought the Marine Hospital that overlooks the harbor. So he is part of the group that's trying to figure out how to buy this and also to look into what it could become.
What kind of time frame is there for this bill?
Nat Benjamin said that the DeSourcy family is working with them and really offering them, you know, plenty of time, he said. So it didn't feel like, you know, the gun was on them or stuff like that. They really want to work it out, evidently, to maintain what it is and even make it better. Interesting thing, this has an interesting history, this area. Back in 1978, McDonald's wanted to move in there. And that was a huge fight and would have, you know, forever changed that area. So back then, the public formed and they fought back and McDonald's was defeated. And that's actually when Gannon and Benjamin moved in. So this time it really feels like something that is more designed so the community will be really happy with it. But again, it's really in the early stages. So we don't know a lot of the details, but Nat Benjamin did say they had plenty of time. Mr. McDonald did say it's going to take a lot of dough, though.
Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy, offshore wind company Vineyard Wind says it plans to help the town of Yarmouth by covering costs as they work on a host community agreement.
Yeah, and Vineyard Wind is expected to come ashore in Yarmouth and specifically in West Yarmouth through Lewis Bay. They're coming from their site that they've proposed south of Martha's Vineyard, and their cables to connect that project to the electric grid would, again, come onshore in Yarmouth. And as is the case, as we've seen with the now-defunct Cape Wind project and other similar projects, you have to work out how you get through a town. It's not as if the town can likely stop them if they do everything right and go through the permitting process. But you want to establish kind of the rules of the road. And also in this case, Vineyard Wind is saying that they will provide some money to the town to help with their upfront costs as the town analyzes how these cables are going to go through their town and eventually hook up to a substation in Barnstable. Vineyard Wind is saying they're not going to be specific about how much money this costs until you kind of get through the process of figuring out what's going to be done and what's going to be needed in terms of, again, almost the prep work for this. But they did say that they want to, good faith, help the town. The town has a lot of concerns. Residents have a lot of concerns. Some of these are similar to the concerns that were raised with Cape Wind as far as any sort of disturbance through Lewis Bay, anything that would happen in terms of pollution from the substation itself. That's primarily in Barnstable, however. But staff in Yarmouth, the selectmen this week, said that their staff could go forward with helping to develop a draft memorandum of understanding that would kind of lay out how they would go forward. They're expecting that to be possibly available at the Board of Selectmen's meeting on August 7th for them to discuss.
You can understand why something like this would be so complicated and for the towns might feel like it's almost overwhelming, and they would welcome that help.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a major electrical infrastructure project basically coming through the towns. Now, it does happen. We've had natural gas pipelines that are put through towns that have raised concerns from residents, and we've had other cable projects from the islands that didn't kind of come to this level. Part of it is, the history of Cape Wind and the turbines being located on the other end of this process. But part of it is, you know, very legitimate questions about what's going to happen with these cables as they come through potentially some sensitive areas ecologically and certainly some areas where there's roads and traffic and everything of that nature.
This next story we've talked about in the past, it moves forward again this week. It has to do with plans to put a cell antenna in a church tower in Centerville. What's happening now?
Yeah, it seemed like this was a done deal, if you will, but residents who were opposed to this, putting this cell antenna in the South Congregational Church steeple there in Centerville, have gained a bit of a victory here. They've convinced the building commissioner, or the building commissioner in Barnesville decided that he would issue a cease and desist order, basically stopping the work. It seemed like it was almost all done, and he essentially has said you can't go any further, and the reason has to do with county regulations rather than even town regulations, but maybe a combination thereof. It's the area is considered a so-called district of critical planning concern. That's a Barnesville County designation, and it limits certain things that you can do. And the way that they establish these areas is the town and the Cape Cod Commission get together and they kind of set the ground rules, and they say within this area you can do X, you can't do Y, and here's kind of how it's going to work. The thing that wasn't included as they established the regulations for this particular area were the town's wireless rules that were included for all the rest of the town, and they were not included for this district of critical planning concern. And because of that, the neighbors who didn't want to see this happen and had health concerns and other concerns based around these antenna were able to hang their hat on that and get this to be stopped. We'll see. This, as has been said previously, is something that really is almost at the federal level more than it is at the local level. And the federal FCC can seemingly override these local concerns and local rules. And we'll see how that plays out. The church itself says, listen, we're trying to survive here. We need some revenue. It's in the steeple. You don't see it. And by the way, there are hundreds of these antenna all around you, and you're not complaining about those. You're complaining about ours because we've been, you know, upfront and transparent about it. Neighbors say that they want more information, and they are not satisfied with the idea that this is a safe thing to have in their neighborhood.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, recreational marijuana laws are rolling out across the state, and local police are training for what that could mean, particularly on the road.
Certainly, and it's one of those questions that came up when marijuana was legalized through the ballot, and one of those that didn't seem to have an answer very quickly, and nobody has been able to answer it, even at this point, even as recreational marijuana facilities and retail shops are expected to be opening up. This week in Barnstable, the Barnstable Police Department hosted a training. It's called an Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Enforcement Course. Checking for sobriety on the roads is nothing new for police. They are looking at this through the lens of people who may be influenced by marijuana as they're driving, or other drugs, really, and trying to figure out how they go about testing that. With alcohol, there are a number of tests, and one in particular is that most people probably are aware of, the blood alcohol test, the breathalyzer that they use, where if you're above 0.08, it's illegal to be driving, and it's very clear. You test somebody's blood. You know, there's all sorts of legal contentions, certainly about the in particular tests, but you test somebody's blood. If they're over that limit, they're considered drunk for the purpose of driving. With marijuana, there's not an equivalent test, and so they're really struggling to try and figure this out. There are some tests, and this kind of gaze stigmata test that they use, that is one way that they say that they can try and figure out if somebody's on drugs and driving. But one of the issues is here in Barnstable County, they haven't been allowed to introduce that test specifically as evidence in a trial, for instance.
What is it like?
It basically is kind of the classic one where you follow somebody's eyes and you can look at how the eyes are reacting to different things and figure out, through that what's going on. It's, again, a test that focuses on the eyes versus one of the ones that say where you do the walking and you can walk in a straight line or not, or hold your foot up. But in any case, in other locations, means that test is allowed into evidence, and police here are saying, well, we can't do that here because just the way the judges have handled it, judges have questioned the legitimacy of that test. And again, you can see the difference between a test like that where you're you know, somewhat subjectively looking at somebody's eyes and trying to follow certain things that are going on there versus a reading of blood alcohol in the case of the alcohol specific test. So they are, but there is a certification program that you can go through. This particular two-day class that they had this week with about 20 officers from the Cape and off Cape didn't get you to that certification, but it prepared people to kind of start looking at how they can determine if somebody's impaired on the road through drugs. A lot more to deal with here, and something that's not straightforward, and something that'll, I'm sure, play out in courts and case law going forward.
Let's speak now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, a group of homeowners is threatening to stop emergency dredging of Chatham Inlet. They're claiming that some earlier dredging damaged their properties. Tell us about this.
Sure. As we've discussed a couple times on the show, there was a lot of damage to the shoreline and to Chatham Harbor during the winter storms we went through, the four nor'easters we suffered through. And one of the major changes there was how boaters access the ocean from the harbor, and that seems to be through the North Inlet, which is opposite Minister's Point. Commercial fishermen are using it, the Coast Guard, and a lot of recreational boaters, but it's not the safest. It's safer than the old inlet in front of the lighthouse, which is really shoaled up, but there is a major shoal in front of the North Inlet that officials hope to dredge to make that safer, because specifically the Coast Guard can't get out that way at all tides. So the town is hoping to do some emergency dredging, and they've been to the Army Corps of Engineers and a number of agencies to try to work out some authorization for that. They do have permission to dredge in the area, but this particular shoal happens to be a couple hundred yards outside of the permitted area, so they need some special authorization. But there's a group of residents who own property around the Minister's Point area, which is directly opposite that North Inlet, and they've thrown up a roadblock. As you say, they said they claim that dredging that the town did back in April of 2017 in Aunt Lydia's Cove, which is about a half mile to the south, they say that that accelerated currents along the shoreline and contributed to damage to some seawalls that occurred during the March 2nd nor'easter. One of these property owners, Gerald Milden, put together a 27-page report sort of detailing these claims, and the residents hired a lawyer. His name is Paul Revere from Centerville, and he sent a letter to the town a week or so ago threatening to file suit if this emergency dredging goes ahead. They're claiming that this dredging could further exacerbate the damage to the shoreline. They're also claiming that there are deficiencies in the town's application to the Army Corps of Engineers. Now, the property owners are calling for the town to immediately stop the permitting process until a meeting can be set up to discuss the issue. This past week, the town officials said they went to they've been to the Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies, which appear to be amenable to this process, to the emergency approval. But because of the threat to property owners, because of this threat, town officials have sort of been a little reluctant to talk on the record about this. They say it could be subject to litigation, so they're saying that they can't really update us further on the process. But what we do know is that this past Wednesday, Coastal Resources Director Ted Keon met with the Conservation Commission and provided them with a overview of the situation. And at this point, the commission hasn't they're required to give their authorization for this emergency permit as well. They haven't done that yet. They're planning on Monday. Members are going to go take a boat ride out to the site and look at the shoaling for themselves. Now, the property owner's attorney had set a July 25th deadline for the town to set up a meeting on this. But according to Chatham's Town Council, as of yesterday, there had been no further communication. And as far as we know, the town is continuing to pursue the dredging permits, and we haven't seen any further evidence of litigation being filed yet. What the town is hoping to do, Steve, is mm-hmm. the the Barnstable County dredge has been in South Chatham along Nantucket Sound, clearing shoals from Mill Creek here in town. And they are hoping that once that is done, which is any day now, that the dredge can swing around to the eastern side of town and begin clearing those shoals. You know, they're citing safety reasons for the Coast Guard and for fishermen and even recreational boaters who, once they get past this shoal, they can get through the inlet, but getting over the shoal can be tricky at some tides.
That's Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for updating us on that.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Oh, hi. We cut out for a second.
Nope. We're here now. Good
morning.
All
right. Good.
Casey, in Wellfleet, there was a meeting of part-time resident taxpayers that would be mostly summer folks who own second homes in town. And these people are looking for voting rights. Is that right?
That's right. Some non-residents, clearly not all, but a vocal number, are interested in being able to vote in their vacation homes. As some second homeowners are allowed to do in the states of Connecticut, New Mexico, and Delaware. So this isn't completely an unrealistic goal, although that isn't the case in Massachusetts so far. The non-residents at this meeting argued that they pay the majority of taxes and are actually the majority of the population in Provincetown, Truro, and Wellfleet, which is true, and yet they don't get a vote on decisions on how their tax dollars are spent. They also say that they have been treated very dismissively and even rudely by residents, the town leaders in their communities. Regan McCarthy of the Truro Part-Time Resident Taxpayers Association said that 98% of her members of the Part-Time Residents Association turned out to vote against the residential tax exemption, which Truro and Provincetown have voted to do, which gives a slight break to year-round residents and charges slightly more in property taxes to second homeowners. And anyway, she said 800 people turned out to meetings and wrote emails to the selectmen opposing this. And then this is what she said about the selectmen's attitude. She said, but the selectmen didn't listen to anybody. They castigated us and turned against us. They basically gave us the bird. They said, we don't care. We think this is a good idea. And then Steve Fasella, who's from the Provincetown Part-Time Resident Association, said something very similar. He said the chair of the Provincetown Select Board came to one of the non-resident meetings in June and said non-residents shouldn't vote because they're not part of the community. And then he also said, part-time residents are not the cause of the problems in this community, and he said that they are marginalized and vilified in Provincetown. So, I mean, this meeting that we covered was hosted by the Wellfleet Non-Resident Taxpayers Association, and so the crowd was obviously mostly part-time residents.
Mm-hmm.
But even within that, there were a few people who said, you know, tying a vote to property ownership is very elitist, and we don't oppose it. Someone else said, we also don't think that non-residents and residents have that widely divergent views on how to spend the tax dollars. But I think this is an issue that's been going on and it's going to continue to heat up. And non-residents, what really got them angry is this residential tax exemption. And Regan McCarthy from Truro said, if Truro votes for it again this year, she's really going to push to get a non-resident vote.
And the residential tax exemption, when you break it down in that article, it's not a huge amount of money. It doesn't seem like against the value of some very high valued second home properties there.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a matter of a few hundred dollars.
Mm-hmm. But it seems more the principle in this case in some ways.
It seems to be. Yeah, I think if you do think about how much. I think somebody said 70% of the taxes are paid by second homeowners. And certainly, if you just look at the number of owners, property owners, the majority don't live year round. So, you know, it's kind of a strange dynamic.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us with that.
Thank you. Take care.
Patrick Cassidy, another story we've spoken about, a number of trees cut down in front of the fish hatchery in Sandwich had folks upset. Now the state is saying that it's going to go and replant them.
Yeah, and neighbors had said that this was an area that was really iconic in terms of how it was set up. These were 30 mature cedar trees on one side of the drive headed into the fish hatchery, which a lot of people like to go down and see the hatchery. I know our photographers like to get out there and get shots of them stocking it and doing those various things. So one side of that drive, had both sides had these trees on them, but they took away the one on one side. And it was very kind of jarring in a lot of respects to see it cut down on the one side because it had this kind of canopy tunnel-like feel to it. And when neighbors saw that, they raised a lot of questions. And as it turns out, the work, which was ostensibly being done, sounded like for two reasons from the state's point of view. One was to make sure that those trees didn't affect power lines in the area. And then secondarily, they were doing it so that they could put in basically a water pipe and pipe water down to the fish hatchery, which you kind of think, oh, well, doesn't the fish hatchery have water? This was potable water, if you will. This was water so that the people who worked at the fish hatchery could have water. There are some questions that came up certainly about, well, why don't you just send them in with bottled water every day or something akin to that. But in any case, they had decided to move forward with this project. They'd gotten permission from the town for parts of this project. But as it turns out, the tree cutting was outside of the scope of what they had asked for in the permit. The town dinged the state on it. The state has come back and said, listen, we'll replant trees, and the town's working with them on exactly what it's going to look like. I don't know that they're going to be able to anywhere near quickly get to the kind of the iconic look that it once had, because those were, I think, some older trees there. So we'll see how that planting goes forward.
And folks really pushing back there, saying if the trees were in the way, you know, there were ways to handle this without cutting them all the way down to the ground.
Yep.
In Truro, a group of farmers has formed a cooperative aimed at growing marijuana to get into the new industry, but some local residents are coming forward now with concerns.
Yeah, and Truro is really where this idea of marijuana cooperatives kind of, you know, the seed was planted, if you will. The representatives who represent that area, Representative Sarah Peek, and then State Senator Julian Sear, had pushed for this measure when the state had redone the marijuana rules after the voters had themselves legalized marijuana. And the idea is that you have these smaller farmers who would be able to get together and share some of the costs and be able to sell into the market and compete with larger companies and kind of bigger business. In any case, there's this five-farm cooperative out in Truro, and I think there's a farmer in Wellfleet as well. And they were trying to go forward with this, but in Truro, the town still had to basically establish their zoning rules. And so they started coming up with ideas for zoning. The cooperative farmers pushed back, saying you're basically going to limit, you know, because these are individual farms in different places. If you start zoning, you're going to take big chunks of land out of the equation, and potentially you know, some of their farmers out of the equation, and some of the other regulations may be onerous for small time farmers operating a cooperative. Neighbors, however, weighing in at this hearing this week, essentially said, listen, we're not sure we want a marijuana farm in our neighborhood. There are security concerns, there's traffic concerns, how are you going to transport it? And they raised a lot of questions about how the whole thing was going to work. Are there going to be marijuana tastings on the property? There's going to be cash involved because of the banking system issues with marijuana retail. How are you going to deal with the odor? Again, lots of questions. And so the town is moving forward with trying to figure out how to deal with this. They are basically competing bylaws that are being touted, one by the cooperative and the other by the planning board. Interestingly enough, I think one of the planning board members said that while at the same time she was kind of pointing out some of these concerns that were raised, she also said, listen, I've reached out to the cooperative's farmers. Every time I've talked to them, they've come up with some sort of compromise. I don't want to demonize them. We want to work with them. As it stands, marijuana is legal, and there's going to be these businesses. How do you work through these problems? Truro is just the latest town to have to address that.
And in the state, this legislation was crafted specifically to allow for cooperatives because of an initiative by the representatives from that region.
Absolutely. It seemed like that region in particular was one where they saw this as a possibility. One of the other interesting quotes, though, from neighbors is like, okay, you allow this kind of commercial enterprise in a residential area, and then say it fails. What happens next? Could a 7-Eleven come in and be built there now because you've established this precedent of a commercial enterprise there? So, you know, as is always the case with new rules and regulations, and certainly it has been the case with medical and recreational marijuana. Primarily, the argument could be made because the state legislators themselves didn't get ahead of this versus having the voters force them into it. There's still a lot of questions as far as what all these rules need to be and what needs to be done.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we will be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And Patrick, the state is looking to make a stretch of Route 6 in Truro a lot safer. What do they have in mind here?
Yeah, and this is in particular one intersection out there in Truro, Route 6 and Shore Road. It's kind of 6A, as some people will know, Shore Road. And it's an intersection that they say, you know, is dangerous and has a lot of traffic going through it. I think it's the highest trafficked intersection in Truro, with 20,000 vehicles going one way or the other on a summer day, according to some data that our reporter Marianne Bragg uncovered. In any case, the State Department of Transportation wants to do this $1.2 million improvement project. It's about a mile stretch of the road that would be affected by this. And more or less, they're looking to kind of move the lanes in a way where it would actually move the transition from two lanes to four lanes, about a half mile north of where it is now. And again, this has to do with kind of traffic at that intersection and that combination of that lane change being right there as well. So it's all these things happening in the same area, and it's a very busy place. Bicyclists are in that area. They're trying to extend the bike path further north, and this is a bike path that they've kind of made on the road. I was just driving on it the other day, and you know, it's basically the shoulder at this point that they're doing. This isn't kind of the rail trail type bike path, but mm-hmm. with that being the case, you have this shoulder bike path that's going through intersections, and all of that happening in one place, combined with the lane change that's there currently, they say has been a problem and has been a danger, more or less. So they're going to move the lane change further on, and that'll kind of alleviate one of those issues in any case.
It is a busy, busy area, especially as bicyclists try to navigate that area. Mm-hmm. We are going to go right now to George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, George.
George, you have an article detailing the frustrations that many residents have with the Edgartown Post Office. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a crazy story, Steve. You know, post office problems over here are not uncommon, but this particular season seems to be really bad. The Edgartown Post Office, Rich Salzberg went out on Monday after seeing a lot of social media posts about issues with deliveries, and saw a line snaking through the building. That's not that uncommon, but then he went outside, looked at the back of the building, and on their loading dock were just bin after bin after bin of packages outside. And the reason for that is they don't have any room inside for them, and it's taking them days and sometimes weeks to sort through them. And we've got a ton of anecdotes from people, not just in the story that we're talking about, but in a follow-up story that we posted online yesterday, just from putting an email, Rich's email address, into our daily newsletter, The Minute. So incredible number of people are upset about this. And we were told earlier this week that the post office was going to send over reinforcements to help sort the mail and get Edgartown Post Office back, you know, operating more efficiently. Mm-hmm. But there's been now, and they also urged people to apply for jobs. But now there's a hiring freeze with the post office mm-hmm. until August 14th. So incredible that, you know, in the height of the season here, there's not much that can be done to alleviate the situation.
I thought it was interesting in the article that somebody said that this time of year for the post office in Edgartown is similar to Christmas week for any other post office.
That's right. I mean, if you think about it, all the businesses over here are dealing with that situation. I mean, there's on any given day, there's 100,000 more people here than live here during the off season. So all businesses have to accommodate that. Unfortunately, the post office doesn't do that like other businesses, and they're trying to deal with this with the crews that they have for the 17,000 people who live here year-round, and that's not going to cut it in any business over here, including the post office.
And you were pointing out the uptick in packages that are now sent through the post office, which is, you know, things like Amazon deliveries for summer residents here.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people on the island, they order things through the mail because either they're not available on the island in various stores and shops, or the price is higher because of, you know, things are coming over on the ferry, and so there's an increase in the price. So people order things like dog food and other essential items that they're counting on getting through the mail or through UPS or through FedEx. A lot of people, I have to say, a lot of the comments are, we've just given up on having anything shipped through the post office, and they try to get it either Federal Express or UPS. Mm.
George, I want to ask you about one other story briefly. A premium fishing catch has returned to Chilmark Harbor after an absence of some years. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. This is Sam Hopkins. He owns the boat Endurance, and he won a $1 million permit through the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust to be able to fish for scallops, sea scallops. And, you know, for a long time, they haven't been available here. I won't go into a lot of deep detail, but we'll say a lot of the fish markets here are really excited about having fresh scallops to be able to offer their customers. Mm. And I will say I'm under orders today to bring some of these home, so I'm hoping there's still some in the stores.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
We're going to go right now to Andy Tomolonis at southcoasttoday.com, the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, Dartmouth prisons have been in the news as inmates there have been protesting some of the conditions. You guys have done some good work covering this. Tell us what's happening.
So, yes, there's been a number of recent protests, and they go back about 2 weeks ago. Last week, we had a story about detainees going on a hunger strike at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Center. So that's the ICE Center at the compound. So Families for Freedom, they're a New York-based immigrant advocacy group that wants to abolish ICE. They told us that at least 60 ICE detainees at the facility began refusing food on July 17th, so that's 2 weeks ago. The group protested on social media that the hunger strikers were protesting deplorable conditions in general, also nearly non-existing medical care, inedible food. They say abuse from facility employees and high commissary prices. A spokesman for the Bristol County Sheriff's, Thomas Hodgson, confirmed that there was a hunger strike, but he said that it ended quickly. We were told that 60 detainees in one wing of the ICE Center refused lunch on Wednesday, then supper that night, six people ate, and then a few more ate the next morning at breakfast, and it was all over by Thursday. And Families for Freedom countered the information telling us the strike continued until at least Friday, and 72 detainees in another immigration unit joined the strike. So it's we're getting conflicting information on it, but we do know that there were hunger strikes. Some complaints from the detainees was that the food was 4 days old, mashed potatoes were yellow, and it takes up to 2 weeks to receive medical attention.
Hmm.
So there's a local prison watchdog group called Bristol County for Correctional Justice. It's been a critic of Hodgson, and it's written a number of letters to us and to others. One of them was urging Maura Healy to investigate Hodgson's practices, and Healy this month sent a letter to Public Safety Secretary Daniel Bennett asking for an investigation into the suicide rate at Bristol County House of Correction, which is higher than other facilities around the state. Hodgson immediately the next day countered, demanded an apology from mm-hmm. Healy, calling her actions politically motivated. So there's a lot going on. And the latest thing that we had is there was another protest this week. We wrote about protest at the House of Corrections on Tuesday and Wednesday. About 250 inmates in the general population, they skipped some of their meals or all of their prepared meals. And their grievances were the food, once again, prices in the prison commissary, mm-hmm. unsanitary conditions in the prison, and disrespect from, you know, the guards, the correctional officers. One additional complaint they had was the oppressive heat inside the prison. And so we had a story today noting that the prison, Hodgson, has failed to prove they have to document the heat in summer and in winter. And only one of those documentations was submitted for the month of November 2015. So there are audits, and where it's a back and forth that's going on here between Hodgson, and Hodgson is generally very receptive and calls the press back, and he's pretty savvy, and he's denied most of what's happened, but acknowledge that there are issues. So we're continuing to cover it.
Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times is with me in the studio. Patrick, a piece of the Cape Cod Rail Trail is closed for construction, but some bicyclists have been sneaking through to travel it anyway. This is not a safe idea, according to officials.
No, that's what they say. And this is a piece of rail trail that hasn't even ever been officially opened yet. This is the kind of to-come access to the bridge that's going over the Bass River, which folks will see as they drive by on Route 6 in that area between Dennis and Yarmouth. And it's going to be, from all looks of it, a really iconic section of the trail. Again, you're going over the Bass River. You're within sight of Route 6. It's a connection that's going to bring the trail further from Dennis towards Hyannis and the ultimate goal of connecting to downtown Hyannis. But it is still closed and it's still under construction. But people are being very aggressive, apparently, about removing no trespassing signs, using bolt cutters to get in. I never really thought that you could be that aggressive about bicycling, but people apparently really want to be on this trail. Officials say it's dangerous. There's the way it's set up now, as it's not finished, you could go off the edge and even go down onto some rocks and into the water, they're saying. So they are saying stay away. They're saying they're putting increased patrol out there, asking the police departments to keep a closer eye on it. Dennis and Yarmouth police departments and Department of Conservation and Recreation folks will be out there patrolling, according to a state official. It is the case, however, on the good news side of things, that they're expecting this section of trail to be open sooner than they had originally anticipated. It was originally scheduled to be done by November. They're now saying it could be open as early as August or September. So if folks just hold off a little while mm-hmm. longer, they can get on it and it can be safe. State officials and local officials are saying stay off it for now, and they'll open it as soon as possible.
If you follow news across the region, the name Judge Gary Nickerson is a familiar one. After 20 years on the bench at Barnstable Superior Court, Judge Nickerson is retiring. Doug Frazier, your reporter, has a very fine profile of him and really captures some of the flavor of the man.
Yeah, absolutely. In my time at the Cape Cod Times, he is the judge. I mean, mm-hmm. he's the guy who, in many cases, was on the big cases. As you said, Doug talked to him about kind of his life, kind of longer trajectory, how he ended up becoming a judge. He was both a defense attorney and a prosecutor at different times before becoming a judge 20 years ago. He's reached essentially the retirement age. The retirement age for judges is 70. He's 69. He's officially retiring in August, but his last day on the bench was this week. And again, he's presided over a lot of these cases. It was interesting, kind of Doug talking to him about his time on his grandfather's farm in Taunton helped him prepare for wanting to examine things, and he brought that into the courtroom in terms of examining, obviously, cases and people. But he had a lot of cases that he was involved with that we all know very well. Certainly the Christopher McCowan murder mm-hmm. trial, who he was accused of the 2000 rape and murder of Truro fashion writer Krista Worthington. That was a case that garnered national attention, and Gary Nickerson, Judge Gary Nickerson, was in the middle of that, trying to control this circus-like atmosphere that surrounded that case. You know, tons of media, lots of different characters, lots of different twists and turns. At one point, he had to, dismiss a juror, and that became a big, big issue. But one thing that lawyers, other judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, everybody who Doug talked to said was, You know, Judge Nickerson is somebody who's thoughtful, who's somebody his decisions stand up. And that was one of the other things they said, you know, his decisions. I think even this week he was still on the bench talking to some attorney, and he basically said, well, that's what the appeals court is for. You know, it's no surprise that they put extra judges on the appeals court when they put me on as a judge. Take it to the appeals court, knowing that in all likelihood he had made a decision that would likely stand up under scrutiny. And that's for judges a really important thing to know, is that when you make a decision that it's not going to be overturned later. Interestingly enough, he kind of talking about what he's going to do in retirement. He's going to be continuing to dig. He said this time he's going to be working on assisting with an archaeological dig at what's believed to be the original Nickerson home in Chatham. So he's not done digging, he said. He went out there and tried it out, and they said he did all right.
I thought he had a wonderful comment about trying to discern between people who were in court because of human frailty, who had sort of stumbled onto the wrong side of the law, and from people who were deliberate in their actions, and he called it deliberate evil.
Yeah, he did, and this is entirely topical when you're looking at something like the Thomas Latinowich case, where there are people out there who have called Latinowich, the man accused of killing Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, evil. I mean, they've said that. And Nickerson actually had a decision to make in Latinowich's past criminal history, and he said he thought he had given him a fairly significant sentence in that particular case. But he did make that distinction between people who, you know, had ended up in the court system by, you know, certainly maybe mistakes they've made, but weren't truly evil, and those people who needed to be separated from society and could not function within society. And you had to, as a judge, and he said he learned that from then district attorney when he was working for him, Phil Rollins, that you really had to watch out for the people who you could kind of move through the system, and potentially they had a end game where they would be, you know, a functioning member of society, and those people who you really just couldn't do anything with, and they had to be put away because they had committed whatever crime they had committed that just deemed them unreleasable, basically, and you had to make those decisions, you know, life imprisonment or whatever the case may be, that would keep those people separate from society. Again, those people he called kind of evil, truly evil.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests of Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Steve.
And Bill Evel from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.